Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases that menace public health. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzwer, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hard to avoid the politics this week. We have pretty much the full suite of who incoming President Donald Trump wants to head the health arms of government in his incoming administration. It is quite a lineup, including former Republican representative from Florida, Dr. David Weldon, to head the Centers for Disease Control. He is someone who has promoted some pretty significantly anti-vaccine views over the course of his career in the public eye, and most notably, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is not a doctor, not a scientist, not experienced running any kind of public agency, to serve in the cabinet as the person who's in charge of the Department of Health and Human Services. One of the many questions that came into our inbox is one from Stephen in Connecticut that arrived, I think, shortly before the news about RFK Jr.'s nomination or prospective nomination. And he asks, whom would you recommend that we turn to for advice on personal and collective health care while our country endures this indefinite period where it's led by those who are unencumbered with the burden of reality?
Well, I think that's a very important question. The good news for us here in California is that you can rely on the state health department, California Department of Public Health. The people involved in the state health department are well equipped in terms of their education and now well seasoned in terms of the pandemic to help guide Californians through public health issues. So I think we're very fortunate here. We can contrast, for example, California with the state of Idaho, which has a very different health department there. I think many of your listeners will recall that in southern Idaho, about a month, I would guess, Brian, maybe 6 weeks ago, they said that they will not deliver any COVID vaccines to the respective counties. I think there were six different counties down in southern Idaho. So it will be spotty for Americans where they can get their solid public health information, but we are fortunate to have CDPH.
What are you most concerned about with someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at the top of the government pyramid? Like, what is he capable of doing? What would you expect to run on autopilot under the guidance of career agency staff?
Well, last week I decided to sit down and start to list kinds of things that RFK Jr. has stated publicly, and I listed things that I could document and gleaned some themes from that. After creating a list of 16 things that he said publicly, usually repeatedly, that have damaged the public's health, I gave up. I'm happy to go through some of those things. I think a lot of the listeners know those. But I can speak first in terms of generalities. He certainly could use his platform to continue to spread misinformation about vaccine safety and efficacy. We know he's done that for several decades now, and there's no reason to think that that's going to stop. He could appoint vaccine skeptics to a variety of advisory committees that formulate vaccine recommendations. Let me dilate on that for a moment. Your listeners may recall the administrative process of how vaccines get approved in the United States after the science has been done. Just briefly, the FDA has an independent advisory committee made up of scientists who have no involvement with the government or with the pharmaceutical industry. And they advise the FDA about the approval, for example, of a vaccine like the COVID vaccine. The FDA doesn't have to necessarily take that advice, but it almost always does. And once the FDA approves the vaccine, then it has to go to the CDC, where the CDC has a similar but independent advisory committee that advises the CDC about how the vaccine should be used, how often should it be given, what doses, et cetera. And the CDC then doesn't have to take the advice of the advisory committee, but it almost always does because these are the top vaccine scientists in the country. Kennedy could essentially get rid of those committees, or probably more likely will stack those committees with people who see the world through his distorted vision. And that those committees could make it very difficult for the FDA and the CDC to really carry out its mission of making sure we have safe and effective vaccines. So that's one way that won't be so apparent to the general public, because it's really in the arcane information about how the government works, but it could have a profound effect. Also, as head of HHS, Kennedy could attempt to limit the access to vaccines by revoking licenses or altering the messages that the public gets about vaccines. And this would, of course, undermine funding for vaccine programs. He could do that independently. There are over 300 immunization programs for vaccines for children that could be severely undermined. And he could, really by using the bully pulpit of HHS and appointing people who could use their pulpits in other organizations, that could really potentially discourage vaccination to the public. And think about another pandemic, and Kennedy's skepticism towards public health measures could really dramatically hinder an effective response. So those are just some of the things that the director of the HHS could do. It's absolutely very, I was going to say frightening, but it's very tragic. The work to build organizations that can help keep us safe can be undermined by putting somebody who's not only ill-informed and not only misinformed, but seems to not be able to see reality. And this can have horrible consequences.
There seems to be more sanguine reaction in health circles to Trump's pick to head the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Martin Makary. This is someone who was an early proponent of masking for COVID-19, was an opponent of vaccine mandates, which, as I understand it, more of a policy disagreement than a disagreement about the actual efficacy of the vaccines. People I've seen reacting to his appointment seem to consider that within the bounds of reality-based, reasonable disagreement. It also seems to be somewhat at odds with the tone that's set by putting RFK Jr. at the head of HHS and someone like David Weldon in charge of the Centers for Disease Control. How do you make sense of that?
Well, he's a professor of surgery at Johns Hopkins, one of the, if not the premier medical research institutions in the world. I found that during the pandemic, there were things that he wrote about and said that I agreed with. There were many more things that he wrote about and publicly spoke about that I didn't agree with, but I could see where a reasonable person would see things differently. And there were some things, albeit not many, that I completely disagreed with him. So I would give him, if it wasn't for the other appointees that Trump is trying to make, I would say he would be a terrible selection for that position, given his lack of experience in that area and given some of the public things he's had to say about vaccines in general. But comparing him to some of the other people like RFK Jr. and others, he looks pretty good. So I guess everything's relative, Brian.
Everything gets graded on a curve. We're speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg. He's clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And we like to devote the bulk of his time to answering your questions here on Corona Calls. The number is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your Corona Calls. Dr. Swartzberg, you talked about the prospect of another public health crisis emerging under the leadership of people like RFK Jr., who don't believe in most of the approaches we've used to addressing past ones. There is kind of like one troubling headline after another concerning avian influenza. Most recently, that bird flu is showing up in large numbers in samples of raw milk collected in California. But also there's a case in Canada, which seems quite exceptional in that it led to a hospitalization of a teenager. And also genetic sequencing of the virus shows several of the mutations that would be expected to make it much more capable of being transmitted person to person. Where is like your threat meter on bird flu right now?
I like your use of the analogy of a threat meter. I would encourage people not to think of the answer to that question as binary. Either there's no threat or it's a horrific threat. It's somewhere in between. What keeps the needle lower on the threat meter is the fact that this virus, while widely distributed now, in many mammals, especially cattle right now here in the United States and other places around the world, and its main reservoir being birds, it hasn't transmitted efficiently to human beings. And when it does transmit to human beings, the most important thing is it hasn't shown person-to-person transmission, and that one person gets it, he or she doesn't seem to be transmitting it to another. So to date, this mammal, human Homo sapien, does not appear to be a good reservoir for this virus. And that's really good news. On the other hand, you pointed out with the really very sad case up in northern Canada, I believe it's British Columbia, where this 15-year-old is still on a ventilator, I believe. He's been hospitalized since the 8th of this month. And his particular H5N1, it's not the type that comes from cattle, from dairy herds, which we're hearing most about, but it's types that are seen in birds and other mammals. And we don't know how he got it. And you mentioned that there are three documented now mutations, two of which make it easier for the virus to infect our cells, and one of which may make it easier for the virus to transmit person to person. Then there's the case in Alameda County of a young child who's doing fine in his home, but has H5N1. It also does not appear to be the type that comes from the dairy herds, but comes from birds primarily, but other mammals. And that, looking at the context of that child, just like the child in British Columbia, there's been no person-to-person transmission. Those two cases didn't transmit to other people. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we are not doing very good epidemiology. And you and I have talked about this before. We are really behind the curve in terms of what we should be doing to really understand better how this virus is transmitting in dairy herds and other mammals, how many people actually are getting infected, for example, dairy workers, but also others. We're just not doing the work that we should be doing about this. We're also not doing some of the really strong science that we should be doing in terms of, for example, vaccine development. When we read about the fact that we have a vaccine for bird flu, we have no idea whether that will work or not. So I would say that I'd give the U.S. response to the H5N1 outbreak we're seeing in dairy herds and then lots of different birds, including, of course, commercial birds, which are keeping our egg prices high because we have to cull those birds. I'd say that I'd give the U.S. response at best maybe a C-. And this is disappointing given that we are just sort of regrouping after the onslaught of COVID. You'd think we'd be a little more attuned to making sure that we're on top of what potentially could be another pandemic. So where are we on that meter that you mentioned? I'd say we're still fairly low in terms of risk, but that could change any moment and we need to be prepared, and we're not.
All right. Let's go to some of the people waiting patiently on our phone lines. Let's start in San Francisco, where Joel is waiting. Good morning, Joel.
Yeah, hi. If the federal government cuts off the state funding for the COVID vaccine, will I still be able to go out of pocket and get it? I mean, right now I get two shots a year from Kaiser, and then I'll pay for a third one, so I can do every 4 months. So what's the possibilities of, you know, the distribution?
Joel, you have health insurance through Kaiser?
Yes, and I also got Medi-Cal.
Okay.
I'm really glad you asked that, Joel. I think it's highly unlikely the federal government's going to, even under RFK, is going to cut off funding for the COVID vaccine. The states are what the major resource of getting the vaccines. And I think we can count on that continuing here in the state of California and other states, possibly with the exception of places that, frankly, are absolutely crazy, like that area of southern Idaho. So I don't think you need to worry about that. I'm not 100% sure, but I think that shouldn't be something that will keep you up at night.
Well, we'll certainly see. Here's a question from the email, Dr. Swartzberg. Stefan in Larkspur had a bad reaction to a Pfizer shot once upon a time and has not gotten boosters since then. Now is planning a trip to the Caribbean and intending to get the Novavax vaccine, which is now in stock at Stefan CVS, and asks, if I'm going to the Caribbean in January, when should I get Novavax for maximum protection during the trip?
2 weeks before he leaves. If he got the primary series with Pfizer way back, then he just needs to get the Novavax vaccine about 2 weeks before he leaves, and he should get a good boost.
Got it. All right. Next on the line, John is calling from Fresno. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I'd like to make a comment before asking my question.
John, we're short on time. Can you get right to the question?
Sure. Would you discuss what the current state of vaccination is in terms of booster? Because your last answer I thought this was to decrease the severity. Has it evolved to preventative protection?
Sure. Good hearing your voice again, John. You're right. The vaccine's major role is to prevent serious infection, making someone so sick they need to go to the ER, get hospitalized, or tragically die. And they do work well, but they don't work for a long time to accomplish that. Months as opposed to years. Within the first few weeks, maybe a month or two, you get pretty good protection against getting sick at all. But after that, for the next 3 months up to about 4 months, your major protection is really against serious illness.
So that's why the timing of the shot becomes significant. It's like how can you use the booster to avoid ruining your vacation by getting sick and isolating?
Exactly. And that's why some people, particularly those who are significantly immunocompromised, may need to get the vaccine several times a year. What we really need is a vaccine that will last a lot longer and doesn't have to be changed each time the virus changes. And I still feel very optimistic that we're going to find that.
Well, that raises an interesting question, Dr. Swartzberg. You and I have discussed, many of the possible routes for getting such a vaccine, research on vaccine boosters that are administered by nasal spray to stimulate antibody production in the place the virus lands and gets a toehold. Vaccines that are rejiggered to present the spike proteins closer together, hopefully to induce a longer lasting B cell response in the body. If you've got someone like RFK Jr. in charge of Health and Human Services, which is ultimately the person in charge of the major federal grant making bodies for research on these types of things, what happens to the development of those types of tools?
Well, I was going to say your guess is as good as mine, Brian, but I don't think either one of us would be guessing in terms of the answer to your question. I think we would see with somebody like RFK Jr. Having authority over the National Institutes of Health, I think we could see a lot of damage done in that regard. This is the man who...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say this is the man who caused over 80 deaths in Samoa by claiming that the measles vaccine was causing autism. And when Samoa stopped vaccinating people, they had over 80 deaths from measles alone, something they hadn't seen before when they were vaccinating.
Right. One more quick question from the inbox. Hugh writes, my general practitioner just told me more people who take Paxlovid get rebound. I thought Dr. Swartzberg said the data says it doesn't. What is true?
Yeah. Well, the data that that most of us rely on was the data from the CDC that they published in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that showed that the incidence of rebound was the same if you took Paxlovid or not. There have been other studies, one out of UCSF and other really good institutions that have suggested that the chances of rebound are greater after taking Paxlovid than if you don't take it. I don't know what the truth is here. It's very difficult to know that. We won't know it for a good while when we need more studies. The bottom line, though, is that if you are a candidate for Paxlovid, we have overwhelming data that it's going to help protect you against serious illness. And you should by all means take it, even if there's a slightly increased risk of rebound. Rebound is almost never as severe as the original case of COVID. It's inconvenient, it's aggravating, but protection is clearly there, not only against severe COVID, but against long COVID.
And there is a possibility of rebound even without Paxlovid. The question is there a relatively higher risk of rebound with Paxlovid? That's what you've got conflicting data on, depending on who's done the study.
Thank you. That's right.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.